Welcome back to We Are YA. I'm your host, Felicity, and joining me this season will be some of our biggest names in young adult literature. Today on the show, Saba Tahir, the number one New York Times bestselling author of An Ember in the Ashes, which has been translated into over 35 languages. She began writing An Ember in the Ashes while working nights as a newspaper editor. She likes thunderous indie rock, garish socks, and all things nerd. Saba currently lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. On today's episode, we're going to talk about the series so far, and that means if you haven't read An Ember in the Ashes series, this episode will be one giant spoiler. So I encourage you to stop listening and go read this magnificent series right now. Otherwise, if you're still with us and you're a giant fan and want to hear all the questions, Saba Tahir, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Felicity. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm very excited to have you on this episode specifically because this is the one I want to ask you all the questions about. And you, I'm giving you permission to talk about the first three books with spoilers, which I feel like authors never get to do.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited. I want to talk about all the people I murder. I really do.
I love the way I can almost feel you rubbing your hands together as you say that. exactly. I want to ask specifically, basically, about the core three. And as incredibly complex characters to change and grow and then fail often spectacularly throughout the series, this is my take on them. And this is just me, so it could be completely wrong, but I see Lyas as the heart of the series. Helene to me is the brain and Elias is the soul of the series. Agree or disagree?
Okay, Lyas the heart, Elias is the brain?
The soul. No, Elias is the soul. And Helene's the brain. She's the thinker. She's the calculator. I'm doing this for these tactical reasons.
I think Lyas is definitely more heart, but I think Elias is even more heart than Lyas, because Elias is very much a how can I save everybody?
Right.
Type person. And he's also very sort of, but he's also the soul, I agree, because there's a lot of moral ambiguity and struggle in Elias. He's always kind of thinking about like how he doesn't want to be an evil, horrible person. So I do think it's accurate that he has a little bit more soul. And I do think it's accurate that Lyas has a little bit more heart. I do think that Lyas is also a thinker, I would say.
Yeah.
I almost think that to some degree, she sometimes thinks a little bit too much, and that can be, you know, then she's overthinking how many ways she can get killed. Right. And
right,
so then she
right.
kind of freezes and doesn't do what she needs to do.
Right.
And then Helene, I think, is very, very much a, gosh, how would you say this? Helene is a thinker, but Helene is also very limited in her thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So she has this kind of rigid worldview, and she is thrust into situations where she is forced to expand that worldview. So in that regard, I think that while she is a thinker, she's a thinker who maybe thinks a little bit more of herself than she actually is.
Right. Yeah, not an empathetic thinker, but like a structured.
Yeah, very structured, thinker. Very kind of like, well, this is the rules, and so this is what should be.
Right.
There isn't, you know, there isn't. I always said that if, you know, Helene had a pastime, I think like baking would be really good for her, because I feel like it would force her to kind of relax and go with the flow and think, which is intuitive to her, but in a way that's more creative.
I somehow don't see her baking. I think she'd get frustrated with it.
Yeah, I feel like she would. I feel like she would start by being frustrated, but then hopefully she'd eventually start to slow down and be like, "This is fun, and there's cookies at the end of it."
Well, Felia, who is our heroine of the main story, her journey starts kind of small and pretty righteously, in that there's sort of she's on a. I hate using words good and bad because there's such a moral complexity to them, but like she's on a path to rescue her brother. That's what she's going to go and do. But at the second she steps out of, you know, even just the backyard, the world really widens for her and her choices become more complex. I want to know, how has that been to like to write that journey for her?
Lyas' journey was one where I really had to think about the arc of her over the series and not just over each of the books. So I had to ask myself, okay, I want Lyas to go from, you know, A to Z. How do I make it so that each book feels complete in her journey, but she also is going through something that's going to take longer than just a book? And the way that I did that was sort of look at where she is and kind of what her impact is, and consider that idea of impact. Like with the first book, she's really impacting a sort of a small group of people with what she's doing, right? And then with the second book, her impact increases. And now, you know, she's impacting a much larger group of people, because we're looking at, you know, all the prisoners in Koff prison. And, you know, we're looking at all these, you know, people who she wants to try to help, right? And then we get to book three, and we're seeing her at the beginning freeing people from ghost wagons, and we see her at the end, and she has, you know, helped to free thousands of scholars. And so each time her impact is increasing. And you can't have that type of expansion of impact on the world without having an expansion of your character. So those two things then track together. And you have, you know, her kind of being more aware of who she wants to help and her own capability and ability to do so. And then her actually doing those things.
Yeah. Well, I think the impact too, particularly like from, as you said, it was small when it was a book one with Blackcliff. And then by the end of Reaper, when she's standing there watching this army kind of descend towards her, you almost feel the weight physically settle on her shoulders of what she has now become for so many people and in her own mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that she will, like any leader, especially reluctant leaders, who often unfortunately tend to be the best ones. She just wants things to be okay, right? Like her wants are not very complicated. She wants her family to be safe. She wants to be with them. She wants the people she loves to be safe, and she wants to be with them, and that's it. She wants to live safely somewhere that feels like home. And in attempting to find that, I think that she's realizing that that's also something that she wants other people to be able to have. And I think that's so often what happens with leaders is that is the case, right? Like they might want something, there might be something that drives them, whether it's, look at someone like, you know, Malala Yousafzai, right? Who just wanted an education, and then something awful happened to her. And then she took that desire she had and decided to, you know, essentially make a platform out of it, right? And be like, I want everyone to have an education. So to some degree, Lai is a little bit like that too.
Yeah. No, I totally say that. I mean, there's other questions I have to ask about Lai, but it involves other people, and I'm not going to talk about them yet. I want to ask you about Helene, who is probably one of the most complicated and I would say controversial lead characters, in that fans particularly have been really strong to call her out, her oppressor status and her colonizer status, and have been really honest about who she is in this world. Has that been difficult for you to write her, you know, with any sense of mercy to her, or also without not betraying where she's grown up and what her world has been?
It can be sometimes difficult to write Helene with empathy, but that's the reason why I actually chose to write Helene. So, you know, I believe that if you are from an ethnic background that has been deeply impacted by colonization, which mine has. I am Pakistani, like I said. You know, Pakistan used to be part of India. It was colonized by the British. There's a very, very ugly history there. It is a history that still impacts families, you know, still impacts governments, still impacts entire countries. that's something that I really thought about when I was going into writing this book, is that, you know, do I want to write from this perspective? And I decided I did, because I wanted to explore that mentality. I wanted to kind of explore, like, what, from the perspective of a person whose history has been negatively affected because of colonization and because of the oppressor and because of the colonizer, I wanted for me, right? It didn't even have to be for anyone else. I wanted for me to understand what you have to be in order to be okay with that. And what has to happen in order for you to be not okay with that. And I think that there's a reason why Helene loses so much. And it's because I do genuinely believe that there are a lot of people in this world who are oppressors and who are colonizers and who have that mentality. And it is not until everything that they love is stripped away from them that they truly begin to understand what they have done to other people. And so my exploration of Helene is very much a how much more can she take before she finally understands? How much more can she go through before she finally changes? What does she have to go through for her to actually change? That's it. That's the reason why I wrote this character. And I know some people find her heroic, and that's their opinion. Some people find her villainous and awful, and that's their opinion. And I think that's great. I think people should have their own opinion about this character. I think that she's a very interesting character to write for those reasons. And I have a lot of friends who love her. And I have, you know, what I think is sort of funny is that, you know, I have a lot of readers who, you know, are from places like Pakistan, or they're from India, or, you know, they're from places in the Middle East, and they really love Helene. They love her for her strength. They love her, and they recognize that she's a colonizer, and they still love her. And I actually think that that's important too, because the, you know, oppression and colonization isn't always just about, you know, let me oppress you under my boot. It's also about the seduction that can happen when somebody has all the characteristics of being an amazing leader, and you want to believe that the things that they're saying and doing are for the good of you, not necessarily immediately realizing that that's not always the case. And this isn't to say that people shouldn't like Helene. I think I totally get why people like her, but it's just to say that she was kind of a social experiment for me in some ways. She was a way for me to kind of work through my own feelings about that sort of deep hatred of the oppressor and frustration with the oppressor, you know, and Helene was my way of kind of working through that. So,
And I think people's reaction to it kind of shows how complicated that kind of still is
yeah,
in everyone's worlds these
yes,
days.
absolutely.
I think the other thing that you do with Helene really well, and interestingly, is the position of her being in this very male-dominated world that she lives in, where she very quickly has to become her own kind of protector, and her own sort of fighter. And it's a hard thing to balance because you kind of constantly you're almost in her corner at times when you really shouldn't be as a reader, and then you should be, and then it's a really impressive feat that you've pulled
Oh,
off.
thank you. Yeah, I think that we have to, if we want to understand why demagogues rise up, not going to name any names here. If we want to understand why people relate to them, and some people don't want to understand that, and that's fine. Like, I'm a person who does, because I didn't understand it at the beginning of the series. Then I do think that we have to sometimes look at these characters who, you know, are so likable. They're so likable, and yet they do these awful, awful things. And that is humanity, right? In a nutshell, that's us. Like, we are so terrible, and yet we can do such beautiful things. And I don't always think that you have to come to a conclusion about a character either, which is something that maybe isn't such a popular opinion, right? I don't always think that it's about deciding, like, I hate this character or I love this character. I don't mind at all if people are unsettled by Helene and they don't know what to feel about her. I think that that's a successful character.
No, and I love the way I've never thought of it that way, but you don't actually, I love you don't have to come to a conclusion about a character. Like
No, I don't think you do. I mean, I think that you
it's
can, I think the characters who you think about afterward, because you're like, were you a jerk face? Or, you know, and I mean, there are some books that I think you can use as that have great examples of this, but I'll use George R. R. Martin, I'll use the series, Game of Thrones TV series. I think Cersei is kind of a good example of someone who's like really awful, but then you kind of feel sorry for her too, you know, and you're just like, but you're also the worst, but then I also know why you're the worst. And so and I've never come to a conclusion about Cersei other than that she kind of unsettles me as a character. And you know, I think that that's okay.
No, I love it. It's a weird thing to say I love that, but like I do. I think it's such a positive thing to have for complex storytelling to just not have an answer about that,
Well,
to not have.
yeah, we like it doesn't have to be unsatisfying, right? Like, it doesn't have to be unsatisfying to not have an answer to a question. Like, you can look at Helene's end in sky, whatever it is, I'm not going to tell you, and be either like good or no, awful, or, you know, I'm so sad or I'm so happy or whatever. And right. you can also be like, huh, okay, I got to think about that.
Yeah. A lot of people are thinking now, like, oh my God, what's going to happen to this guy? Well, the other person's name who I'm going to say, and I say it with an exclamation mark every time I say his name, is our dear Elias, who is such a bittersweet whenever I think of him, because he's so, he feels everything so deeply.
He's so emo. But it, my goodness.
He's so emo. He's so, like, it's there underneath all of his kind of, like, outward stuff, but it's after years of being beaten down and like being told he was something that he wasn't, and then even when he breaks free, he kind of goes that I'm gonna redeem myself through self-sacrifice route, which I'm just like, no, but it's a good thing to do, but it's not a good thing to do. Why do you torture us with Elias?
You know, I think that Elias is a really great example of like the impact of generational trauma. And of like childhood trauma. I think that we look at Elias and we see someone who's strong and brave and, you know, very moral. And yet, you know, he makes these decisions that we wouldn't necessarily make, like in Torch, right? The thing that gets Elias into trouble is that he ultimately decides that saving Laia's brother's life is more important than his own future, and that saving Laia's life is more important than his own future. Would I make that choice? I don't know. I don't know if I would make that choice. I might be like, I'm sorry, friend, your bro is, you know, out of luck, you know?
No, nice to meet you. I'll be over here. Good luck.
Good luck, right? But Elias makes that choice, and I think that part of him making that choice is this idea that he has in his head that that's all he's worth.
Right.
That his worth is in what he can do for others and not necessarily in, you know, what he means to others. And I think that that's something I have struggled with. And I think that it's something I still struggle with. Almost like the, like, you know, me justifying my presence in people's life with what I can offer them, as opposed to, well, maybe I'm just, I should just be in their life because I'm like rad.
A good person.
Right. Yeah. You know, yeah. You know, that I'm fun and I'm this and I'm that. And I think that's something a lot of people struggle with, because I've had many, many conversations with readers about this and about why they relate to Elias. And it often does come back to that feeling. And yet Elias has such deep self-belief in certain parts of himself, right? Like Elias never right. walks into a battle thinking I'm probably gonna lose. He's always like, well, of course I'm gonna win. Of course I'm gonna win. Like, what? It's not even a question, right? Like, there's a scene in Reaper where he walks into a guard house that he has to sort of take over, like a drum tower that he has to take over. And I mean, he's not even thinking, oh, you know, this guy's pretty big, or there's two soldiers there, I'm, you know, I could be in trouble. He's just like, no problem.
Got this.
Good night. You know, like, it's not a thought for him. So that is Elias's contradictions, and those are the contradictions that exist in all of us, that we can be, you know, sort of spectacularly confident in some areas of our lives, and yet in others we are not so sure of ourselves, and our footing is a little less stable.
Yeah.
And that's why I think we see Elias as kind of that that character that you really feel for, because I think deep down somewhere we recognize ourselves in him.
Yeah. But also that, like, I think what's heartbreaking is that his spectacular confidence is in a skill that he didn't choose.
Yeah.
He didn't choose to have that life. And that's why he
hates himself for it, right?
Yes.
He absolutely hates himself for it. Like, he's not sitting there going like, I'm a badass. He's just like, well, I know that I'm going to be able to kill all these people because it is the thing that I was trained to do.
Right.
And, you know, he doesn't have the confidence necessarily to be, you know, like, he doesn't say, I will be able to escape this school, or not school, this prison. And maybe I won't be able to save Darren, but, you know, I'll be able to get out. And, you know, he never says to himself, I can't do this. And I'm sorry, there's going to be another way. You know, you're going to heal, you're going to get over this horrible thing that's happened with your brother. But, you know, he never says that. He's very much like, no, I've got to do this. I've got to do this for the person I love. Very self-sacrificing. So.
But also, and what is the beautiful bittersweetness of his relationship with Lyra is that they almost have the complete opposite of that. Of her confidence in her own sort of outward skills is slowly growing throughout the series, but it's not. But she knows who she is on a fundamental level, whereas it's almost the inverse for him. He knows he can fight his way out of any battle, but does he know who he is?
Yeah, and that's why I think that's why they work, because they are what the other person needs. You know, and that's how a lot of good relationships work. Not all, but a lot of them.
No,
you know, my husband is, you know, this very confident person, very confident. He genuinely, there are so many times where, you know, he would say or do something, and I'd be like, "Are you sure that's gonna work?" And he'd just look at me like, "Of course it's gonna work. What? Like, why would you? Like, why would you? Why are you asking? Right?" And it can be small things, and it can be, you know, bigger things, but his confidence in me is what really helped me get through these books, because I sort of got to this place where I was like, well, I mean, I can't fail now because, you know, he's expecting me to, you know,
like, he's told me I can do it.
He's told me I can do it. He's just so sure. And I wish that sometimes that the confidence had begun as my very own, but that's not how it is for everyone. You know, some people are very, very confident, and I applaud that, and I think that's beautiful. And some people are more like me or like Lyon. We don't really have that. And we kind of need to sometimes hear that from other people before we can start hearing it from ourselves. And again, not the greatest way to be, but it is a real part of our world. No. So.
And it's why Helene and Elias were never going to work.
Nope.
Because and I know that there are people out there who still think they should be together, but because he hates what he has to do, there's still a part of her, even in Reaper, that has pride in what she does.
Well, she has pride in what she does, and she genuinely believes in the Empire.
Right.
That doesn't go away. Like, Helene believes. No. Like, she drank the Kool-Aid. Like, she might have started to think that, like, the Empire has made mistakes. You know, the Empire has messed up. But, you know, the fact that you get to the end of Reaper and she's like, wait, what? You freed the slaves? Like, if there's anything that I think should tip people off that there is a deep, you know, streak of villainy in this character, it's that. Like, you can't really get more clear than, you know, her sister's like, this is wrong, and it's been wrong for a long time. And Helene kind of going, well, but is that the best choice for the Empire right now? Right? Like, that's such an awful but also typical thing for a colonizer to think. Like, they are thinking of the Empire. Like, how many crimes were justified for Britain in the name of, you know, the Queen? You know?
Yeah. Or the Commonwealth.
Right? Like, how many things have our governments justified as, well, this is for the safety of and the security of blah, 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 blah. But how many times has it really been about that? Or is it something far more sinister, which is just that you have power, you want to hold on to it? And I think that's really what we're exploring a lot of with Helene, particularly in Sky, is there are moments of reckoning for Helene in Sky.
Yeah.
And I think that those moments are a long time in coming. And I totally understand why some people might just be like, why have I had to follow this journey? I don't want to follow the journey of a colonizer. And I think that my hope is that those moments of reckoning will be very satisfying. Because they can, you know, reckoning can be, that's a beatdown.
You know? Yeah. No,
and some people deserve it.
you're right. And she kind of does. Because, like, as you said, she's at many points throughout the series so far, she's still kind of like, well, if this hadn't happened, we'd still be cool, right? And you're like, no, it was bad from the jump.
Yeah, it was bad from the jump.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the thing, is that I do think I wanted that character in the book, because I do think it's important to have that balance. Oh, yeah. I also want to point out that Helene is in her early 20s.
Right.
She's really young, right? And so there's a lot of people, I think, who are like, well, why doesn't she, you know, and how come she doesn't know? And it's like, you know, generally there's a reason that a lot of the, you know, statesmen who kind of get far in life, right, are like, you know, in their 30s at least, or 40s, right? And it's because they've at that point survived and witnessed things that help them kind of understand how life should be, and they're not naive anymore, and they're not drinking the Kool-Aid, and they're, you know, not always, but I'm just saying that, like, the statesmen who I think are moral people And I'm sure there'd be people who argued whether that was a real thing or not, right? They'd be like, is that really possible? I don't know. But you know, they have survived a lot. And so I think that, you know, you look at the Shrike and you kind of think, okay, you know what? Like, she still has a lot of learning to do. And Skye really answers the question of, does she have hope? Or is she never going to learn what she needs to learn? And is and is it just that it's going to just end in death for her, because that path does not exist for her? And that's what you'll find out when you read the book, right?
Well, and to Helene's villainy, I want to jump to the villains of the series and ask the question of, or pose the question really, of what you do so beautifully in this series is that clearly in every villain we meet, both from, you know, low-key, Keenan-ish kind of people to the Commandant, everyone thinks of the hero of their own story.
Yes.
Everyone, if you read the Commandant's version of An Ember in the Ashes, it would be completely different. But also, like, I feel like she would be like, this is what I've got to do.
Yeah.
This is the thing.
Yeah.
How hard is that to do, so that, like, well, you've got to obviously make them still the villain, they have evil things to do, but also add that layer of, like, but this could be right for them?
I think it's really about motivation. It's about asking what a character's motivation is. So why are they doing the things that they're doing? I think the flattest villains are the ones where you don't really feel that. So, like, I always really struggled with Voldemort as a villain. Because he never really scared me that much. First of all, like, I was never like, oh no, Voldemort. I was like, oh God, this guy. Right. and the reason that he didn't scare me is that he was just like a murderer, and he had his sort of pure blood, you know, half blood stuff that he said, but there was no, there was nothing deeper. It felt like, it just sort of felt like he was a bad seed. And I think that when someone's, quote, just a bad seed, they're very easy to hate and very easy to kill, right? It's just like, you know, you're a bad seed, you need to get destroyed. And that's what you see in, you know, so many movies. And, like, you know, when you watch the Die Hard movies or, you know, whatever, it's like the bad guy. That's what he is. And maybe,
and they're dead. And we're so, yay.
Yeah, it's like, and now they're dead. And, like, maybe we get a little bit of their motivation, but it's always weak motivation. Right?
Right.
It's always like, you know, you meet the bad guy and, like, he's really upset because he was ignored at work, and you're just like, and then now he's a super villain and you're just like, come on, seriously. Or, you know, well, he was orphaned as a child. And now he's really angry because everyone else has parents. And it's like, I wanted to look at stuff that was things that we could relate to, you know, like the Commandant going through. I wanted to kind of look at the line between love and hate and how quickly that line can be twisted again, because of war, because of war that people decide is worth raging, and how that can, what type of monsters that can create. And so that was a lot of the sort of impetus behind why I wrote the Commandant and Marcus and the Nightbringer the way I did. Was I didn't want to give them motivations that felt flimsy or that didn't have any depth to them. I wanted them to feel really relatable, like someone you might know. And, you know, you might know that person and they might just go a little bit, you know, I mean, the Nightbringer's wife and children were murdered.
Yeah.
His entire population of people was locked away. He is pissed. And I can 100% relate to that. Like,
yes.
I don't, you know, and I can't spoil anything about, you know, the Karis's reasons and sort of what kind of drove her to this sort of madness that she's possessed by.
Yeah, I'd like to know, please.
Yeah, but that comes out in the fourth book, right? And, like, we start to kind of understand a little bit more about her and maybe understand where some of those, where that part of her came from. And also when that doesn't matter anymore because you've just gone too far. You've gone beyond, and you cannot be redeemed or saved.
Yeah. Because there are so many characters, both on the good side and the bad side, and I'm using good, doing inverted quotes, really, like no one can see them, but that have this dual kind of character part of it. Like, it's Karis and the Commandant, it's the Nightbringer, and Keenan, to a point, is the Nightbringer in some parts.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Marcus and his brother is almost his flip.
Yeah.
You know, and Elias and his soul catcher responsibilities later on. Like, there's this sort of dual kind of character stuff pushing through, but yet nothing is simple. And Cook as well.
Yes.
Like, there's all this, like, kind of two people, one person fight going on.
Yeah, and I think that that's the, you know, the divisions within us, like, that's something that I thought, you know, I wanted to kind of highlight, because I don't think any of us are one person, you know? And I think that as you kind of, you know, when you're younger, when I don't want to say when you, so I'll just use myself. When I was younger, I had this belief that I kind of knew who I was. And then as I got older, I was like, I don't think I know who I am. And then as I got older, I was like, okay, I think I know who I am. And then, you know, I had children, and I, you know, I remember someone, some woman shoving my child at a Target, and I have never felt that kind of like wrath, you know, and, you know, we ended up in this bizarre altercation, and, you know, she was racist and saying awful things. And, you know, I was really angry. And I just remember that feeling of like, I don't feel like myself, like I'm so angry. You know, and kind of realizing that, you know, there's a lot of layers to us as people, and you sort of discover them as you go through things. I think some people discover those layers when they're like, you know, 12, and they go through, you know, certain experiences, and some people discover them when they're 30 or 40 or 70, right? And and realize all these things about themselves. There's this great book called No Time to Spare, I think, No Time to Lose or No Time to Spare, by Ursula Le Guin. And it's a series of essays from like her 70s and 80s. And a lot of those essays are just about things that she's learned over the course of life, but some of them are about things that she is in the process of learning. And it's such a beautiful concept, right? And so, so like that duality, I think, is reflective of people learning about themselves.
Yeah, no, it's all through the story so beautifully. Now we've got a couple of minutes left, and I want to get to two very important questions, and it's kind of going to be like rapid fire at you. Hardest person you had to kill, hardest scene you had to write.
Okay, the hardest, I'll start with the second one. The hardest scene I had to write was when Laya realizes that her mother killed her sister and her father in prison. That was really hard. Like, that was a very, very difficult scene to write. And I had planned, you know, I knew it was going to happen. I'd planned it for years and years at that point. But I still, like, danced around. I, like, wrote the scene after it. I, like, wrote well beyond it before I was fine. I'm like, Saba, you got to go back and write the scene. And then I went back, and I was grumpy for, like, 3 days. It was not pretty. That was the hardest scene for me to write.
Oof.
And then, very similarly, her death, Cook's death at the end of three was really, really difficult, because they had just found each other. Yeah. They had just found each other. Like, how horrible.
I like the way you say that, like, you didn't do it.
Yeah, I know, like, right? Yeah. Like, I was just like, what's wrong with you, Saba? Like, why are you so mean? But that's the duality talking. But yeah, that was the hardest. So those two pieces, just in that same book, that was really emotional and sort of unpleasant for me to write.
Okay. Well, the duality, it goes again. Who was your, and I don't say favorite character, because I know it's like picking a child. Who was your favorite person to write sometimes? And then what was your favorite scene to write?
My favorite character to write is the Nightbringer. I don't get to write enough of him, but I really, really love to write his point of view. I think that he's such an interesting character. He has this really long history. He knows so much. So he's my favorite character to write. And then in terms of scenes, my very favorite scene with him is at the end of Sky. So I can't say any more than that. You know, you'll see him. He's coming back. He's not going to let you. He's not going to let anyone escape. But yeah, so my favorite scene that I wrote of his, and it's probably my favorite scene that I ever wrote, is toward the end of Sky.
Okay. And I have to ask, as this, it's a fantasy series known for its bloodshed and violence and everything. It also, though, is known for its incredible relationships. As an Elias and Laya shipper, and you know this because I've told you this, what was your favorite romantic scene of theirs to write? And I'm just asking as a fan now.
So I know that a lot of people really loved the end scene in Reaper, and then they were really mad at me because I basically like cut it off. My favorite scene of them is actually the room scene when they first kind of feel like they're on each other's level at the beginning in Ember. I really love that scene between. There's another scene between Laia and Elias that I really love, and that's early in Torch. When Laia's kind of freaking out and he's like, you're going to be fine. You've got this. Because that really sticks with her, right? That it really sticks with her that he said that, and that he didn't just say it because he felt like saying it. He said it because he really believed it.
He meant it. He meant it.
He meant it. He did mean it.
Well, I could stand here and ask you questions all night about all of the characters, but I won't. So I want to thank you for joining us on today's spoiler-tastic episode of We Are YA, talking about An Ember in the Ashes and the upcoming A Sky Beyond the Storm, which comes out December 1st.
Thank you so much, Felicity. It was such a pleasure.
Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time on We Are YA.